like session number 11261, reel 8.
Dr. Pavulovich, reel 8.
Reel 8.
So he admitted that it was on his orders. Those soldiers and, you know, the officers who carried out those duties were told. But that wasn't deception. But if that wasn't deception, what was it? What was it? When I tell you, no, don't tell the truth. Tell them something different. So he objected being called a liar. I'm afraid he fully deserved it. And I can't understand for the life of me why a jury found so much in favor of him. But he proved himself there and then to be a cheat. And he knew more, but of course, all right, what he didn't say, you can't judge that. But he admitted that he told and issued orders to tell, to not to tell the truth. Well, how economical can you be with the truth? How far do you go and still not call yourself a liar? I can't swallow that, I'm sorry. And he still thinks he's an upright person. I'm afraid those millions of whatever he gets, or thousands and thousands, may choke him one day, because he really doesn't deserve much better, because he can't live with his conscience and say, well, surely I can rest in peace, I can enjoy these riches now, because I'm fully vindicated. He must know deep down in his heart it was all a travesty.
Do you think that you have indicated earlier that you feel the matter should not rest there, you know, with the verdict of the
trial? I definitely feel, because this was just a libel case. I think now that this should be, the whole thing should be examined impartially by an impartial body. Cowgill report was, well, done independently. I mean, all right, they went quite a long way towards unraveling, but there's a long way to go. And they, on their report, it came out quite clearly that it was General Robertson who changed the orders, and he was working closely with Toby Lower there. So it really, all of a sudden, orders which came from the Foreign Office or from the British government were redirected. Now, Robertson is, in my view, one of the main culprits, because he was the chief of, what was he, chief of staff or something of the kind. And from him disseminated all these orders, and they were passed on to all those, you know, staff, brigadiers, officers, who again disseminated them through their respective units. So, no, we definitely need, and very soon, an impartial commission which would not sit in judgment. I mean, I'll stress this, not to condemn or to praise, simply to establish facts. Simply, who did what? If orders were changed, why were they changed? By whom? Where does the responsibility for this stop? And where does the new responsibility arise? Who was behind this? What were motivations and reasons? Without saying that Tolstoy is a culprit or Aldington is a devil or Cowgill are misguided and whatever it is. Unless this is done very soon and facts established as far as possible, although there are so many unknown and intangible facts about it, I still think that a great deal could be established. And there are still documents sufficient, particularly if the British government allowed access to some of those vital documents from those days, then I think the truth could become quite clear. All right, let's leave it to somebody else later to pronounce judgment when all these passions have died out or died down or calmed down and when people become less partisan and all this. But I think unless we do something very soon and have a public inquiry, and it should be public inquiry, then a lot of this would be buried and lost to posterity. And we will still not be any the wiser. That's how I feel about it. But I don't know.
You mentioned also earlier, you know, in passing, this issue of the double standard.
Yeah.
You know, in as much that people can be, the Axis powers could be accused of crimes which perhaps the Allies cannot, as the victors.
Well, you're the victor, yes.
Do you think that that applies?
Well, yes, it does. I mean, had the Germans been victorious, many British officers and politicians would have found themselves in the dock. They would have found guilty, I mean, of atrocities and bombings of Dresden and various other cities, bombing Belgrade and various other atrocities, you know, over innocent people, over this repatriation. I mean, this is quite unbelievable. You know, the Germans, if anybody was a criminal, it was the Germans. But they were not just handed over to the Russians, although they had some, they kept them rather than, you know, get some of them were sent there. I don't know how justifiably. But, yes, they would have found so many things that to make them convincingly guilty and condemned and, you know, I don't know the penalties. So really, you are the victor and you make the laws to suit your particular, I'm afraid I'll use the word prejudices here because it is prejudices. It is or sensitivities or whatever. But we are smug about it. We say, oh yes, look, we came as top dogs. And therefore the Hitler and his SS lieutenants are the criminals. I think Waldheim is far worse than what Goebbels did. But he lied. He lied in his teeth. And he lied and the kind of manipulation that went on. He didn't. Yugoslav authorities didn't submit their evidence about him because he obviously knew something about Tito. He knew something about these negotiations, and I suspect he may well have been present, although he's not mentioned, but he was in Bosnia at that time, you know, down in, you know, South Serbia. He may well have been in the know of what went on there. I said, right, well, if you insist on this, then we will reveal something about those events. So it was a kind of, you know, tit for tat. You keep quiet about this, we'll keep quiet about this. But he lied. He lied. And he lied. He was distinctly shown in those pictures with two leading generals, the Italian and the, you know, General Lohr, acting as their, you know, intelligence officer. But he was also one of the top few people there carrying out action at his own discretion. I personally believe he was guilty for the murder of those British commandos. There was an inquiry. It wasn't the whitewash. Why? Because even today, he is the president. We mustn't offend him. We mustn't come out with the truth. That may be painful. He was lying about these things. In fact, the documents were destroyed while he was at the United Nations. You heard about, you know, the manipulations and how people were refused access to those documents and how they had been tampered with. Why? If there was nothing to hide, why all that trouble and fuss? So he's not all that innocent. But to the Austrians, he's the hero. And you know, I mean, you probably know this, I'm only repeating the obvious, that proportionately, a greater percentage of the Austrians were in favor of Hitler than the Germans themselves. Did you know that? You did know. Now, I think that speaks volumes. Waldheim, he kept quiet about his war years. He kept about his party membership and all this. Why? I can't see that he was compelled to do this. He did it because he was enthusiastic. He was carried away with this national fervor. When Janet was in in Yugoslavia and met some of my young relations, younger people, she said, well, they all have Communist Party membership card. I said, well, they have no option, because if you haven't got it, you are on your own. You're in trouble. So practically everybody there had to have it, to show that they're not at least anti, even if they're not enthusiastic for this. But I don't think that would apply to many Austrians, including Waldheim. He got away with it.
He's one of his excuses was, like Lord Aldington, wasn't it, that he was only obeying orders?
Of course. Then why not say, I did this, that and the other, but I was under orders? Why then to try to deviate? Why try to pretend it didn't happen? All right. We can understand that would be more honourable. All right. You felt a conscientious soldier. You carried out what you were told, just like Major Johnson did when he gave us his word of honour that we were going to Italy. He was told to lie, and he did. Well, at least I respect him more for this, because he at least, all right, he acted as a soldier, as a major in that particular instance. And that's it. But if he tried to sort of start finding excuses, then of course it would be abominable. So, I don't know. But going back to our question, issue, I think this matter ought to be and must be investigated. I've been still thinking about, writing. I saw my MP, I told you that on the phone. I told him about this, and he wanted me to write him a letter, and he would pass it on to Mrs. Thatch and all that. But I'm afraid I become rather disillusioned about it all. Because if she is one responsible for keeping those documents secret now. Now, if she is doing that now, how eager would she be to allow much else to be done? Would she allow those documents to be accessible at least to serious historians, if not to the general public? I don't see why not. Now that communism has collapsed all around us, even in Yugoslavia it is on a shaky ground, I don't see why we should be protecting. And if we are protecting, I would like to know who is it we are protecting. You can understand the documents relating to the royal house and their contacts with the Germany and Hitler's Germany. They may be compromising because some people may be hit very forcibly and very unpleasantly. All right, you can understand that sensitivity. But I don't see why protecting Tito, why protecting and his allies or whoever was there. Now, some of those people have come out quite openly. Some of them have, like MacLean, what is he's given rich, sumptuous villas in Yugoslavia, and he's there. He's done very well out of it. Many people say he was paid very handsomely in gold as well. We don't know that. It's only hearsay. Some people say that Hochevar was also in a position to offer bribe to some of the people responsible for our repatriation. We don't know. Did you say you've been in touch with him? Or are you going to... Will anything come out of it? Will he admit? Because he would be in the know. I don't think he's lost his memory. All right, he was on that side. Whether he still believes what he believed, then I do. But many communists have become disillusioned, most of them. So obviously, in a way, it seems to prove the rightness of my way, or our way, although we are few, and the wrongness of what those people did. But they were, in those days, they were convinced they were doing the right thing, and the only right thing, and no one else could be in a position to claim differently, or to know better. Stalin was the same, like that. Tito was the same. All other, these little gods, or tin pot gods, have been the same. Zhivkov and Honecker and Carnegie and Gomulka and the rest of them. Now, we hear a different story. Ceausescu didn't live to tell a different story, but who knows? He could have told a different story like others did, even become a reformed character. Well, if others could do it, why not? And I still, we talked about Gilles several times. I still believe to this day that Gilles is still a very, whatever people may think here, he is a communist, and he has never denied it. He has never said, I feel ashamed of what I did. I never read it anywhere in his writings. Oh, yes, he has criticism to say, but he didn't say, I am ashamed. He still says he's, what, 75% communist or whatever it is. In other words, he may have, disagreed on some points, but he's still, his heart is there. All right, let's give him credit for that. But let's not make him into a kind of hero now. Here is somebody that probably become Tito's heir presumptive as a successor in a non-communist society. Because some of us would have been that naive that we would have gone. Some of our immigrants would have accepted him as a reformed character. Yes, it's a fact. I wrote an article about it. trying to prove that thesis. It's not acceptable to everybody, but I suspect that there is something here that ought to be taken a little more seriously. All right? He and I have been in touch. I mean, he's quoted me in his one of early books in the 60s about, this is a different story, about Bishop Niegosz that I have written a lot about. So I was, in a way, very pleased about it. It was, Zsika Prvulovic, have said this, and quoting whole paragraph. I consider that, that this is quite a recognition, because he's no mean writer himself, and a scholar in many respects. But nonetheless, it doesn't stop me from saying, well, Milovan, sorry, you haven't renounced those beliefs, and he is responsible. He knew what was going on in Slovenia when these massacres were going. He did some terrible atrocities, carried out atrocities under his command in Montenegro. The dog's grave, for example, and where thousands of people were buried and treated worse than dogs. That's why it's become known as the dog's grave and the graveyard and all that. So he is implicated as very deeply in it all. All right, now he has retired, and I don't think whether he will be recalled. I mean, after all, he's getting on. We all getting on.
It sounds, from what you've been telling me, with this mix of people in the country which is called Yugoslavia, it seems that 40 years on, that the groups are still as distinct from what one hears of the rivalry between the different areas.
I would say more so.
Do you think that? My question was going to be, is there any chance of the groups really integrating?
I'm afraid it's worse now. It's worse between the Albanians and the Serbs, for example, in Kosovo. But that's not the worst of it. I mean, if you take Croatia, and I mentioned some of the atrocities that Pavelić and his Ustashes carried out. Today in Croatia, the Serbs are not allowed to use their Serbian alphabet. The language is not allowed to be called Serbo-Croatian or Croatian-Serbian, which has been, even under Austro-Hungarian monarchy, even under Pavelić. Today this is outlawed. Slovenes didn't allow Serbs to go to Ljubljana to protest, to a protest meeting. I mean, after all, if it is democracy, and the movement between different countries, or provinces or republics is free, did they have to stop people, to start arresting them, to stop them going to a protest meeting? Just a protest meeting. They were not going to fight or come in with arms, just to express their concern about Kosovo. Oh, no, the Slovenes stopped them. And that's worse. And yet, during the war, we were their best friends. We received them when everybody else rejected them. When the Germans kicked them out, they didn't go to Croatia, they came to Serbia. And we provided for them, we sent them to various families, in ones and twos or families where possible, and they were looked after. They were given jobs, they were provided with, decent life. Today we are kicked in the teeth by those same, their descendants, Slovenes. So I'm afraid things, yes, are worse.
Is this reflected, do you think, in the Yugoslav people who have settled in Britain? Do the Slovenians keep themselves apart from the Serbs and so on, do you think? Or are you more integrated?
Well, there are not many of them. But as far as I know, yes, we had some who are very profoundly integrated with what we still believe in. We believe in Yugoslavia, although I think it's a misguided. I mean, I'm becoming more and more disillusioned. I think that, as a Serb, I think we are losing much more from that artificial state than we would be. Serbia would be doing far better if it was left on its own. Much smaller country, but at least it wouldn't be maltreated in the way it is being treated now. The Croats are definitely keeping on their own, very much following in Pavelić footsteps, although they wouldn't like being called Ustashes, but they are spiritually, they are his descendants. And they're very much, although they don't say this, you know, we are Ustashes, they're very much for their independent Croatia. Well, we would be much better off. Because I'm afraid. Have you got any Scottish links? You have. Well, you won't mind me if I say that. The Scottish are mourning all the time. They're so badly treated. But this United Kingdom is spending a lot more per capita for every person in Scotland that's spending on the rest, on people in England, for example. And yet, they're hard done by. They are dissatisfied. They want more. Well, Croats were like that, but much more so, because they were, I told you before, they were not only our masters, the civil servants, and occupying the most lucrative positions, but at the same time, they didn't allow any of our people to have any jobs in their province. They're not allowing churches which were destroyed by Ustashes to be rebuilt. Recently it happened that this was again in Croatia. The local priest went and held a service on the church ground where an Orthodox church had been in the past and was destroyed by the Ustashes. Not allowed to read. Now, the priest and people who took part in the service are criminals because they had the audacity to hold a service on that spot, which belongs to the church. Well, the Pavelić didn't do something like that, or at least, you know, he came out and he destroyed the church, set them to fire, and that was it. But it didn't stop the language being called what it is. No.
So, and do you find in this country that these groups are still very much apart?
Oh, yes, very much.
You don't mix with the other?
Well, there are not many of them here, no, because they just don't want to have anything. And neither we do, I'm afraid, because we don't speak the same language. But they're very, very powerful in Canada, for example, in Australia, I mean, in Toronto. There are thousands and thousands of them. And they're still celebrating the Day of the Republic, you know, when Pavelić came to power and that kind of thing. And the Canadian government has been tolerating this for years. Only until recently, until a year or two ago, when the serious protests were raised, when it was made known to the Canadian public who Ustashes were and what was, you know, their behavior during the last war. So the government has stepped in and prevented one or two of these. So they are really clamoring for, you know, much greater concessions and freedom, as if nothing has been done, as if, you know, they're perfectly blameless. So in Australia, again, there have been terrible things. And, well, even here, you may have read about somebody was assassinated up in Scotland. When was it? A few months ago. But I think this was done by somebody who was sent from Yugoslavia, but he was a Croat, I think. So, what was exactly behind that is difficult to know. I'm afraid things are not improving. After these 40, 50 years, we haven't learned much. The communist regime there hasn't exactly helped. And everybody, you see, even the Communist Party itself, there was a Communist Party of Slovenia, which existed before the war. There was Communist Party of Croatia, which existed before the war. There was no Communist Party of Yugoslavia. So those other communist parties and leaders have been deciding things for Serbia. So Serbian Communist Party was founded only after the war. It's very peculiar. Tito, well, supposedly coming from Croatia, no friend of Serbs, and of course he hated Serbs because they were his staunchest enemies, because Serbs were the only ones fighting him. In Croatia, when Ustašis were behaving so atrociously to the Serbian population, many of these people were forced to flee. The only way of escape was to flee to the mountains and join other Chetniks, which were fewer and less well organized, or the partisans. And what they would do, I mean, as soon as you are coming as a novice, they would give you a nasty piece of work to do, shoot somebody, or do some sort of criminal kind of thing. And then after that, they wouldn't have to worry about you, that you will escape, that you will desert them. He said, you do that, it will become known that you killed so-and-so. And they got that hold over you. And they did it in thousands of cases. Well, it worked in many cases. Would you dare desert? Because you would be immediately apprehended as a criminal, as a murderer. So willy-nilly, whether you liked it or not, you would stay there and you would just hope for the best. So that kind of unhappy situation, complex, unfortunate, but in many ways highly disturbing. And we still haven't learned our lesson. And I don't think we will. I'm becoming more and more of a cynic, I'm afraid. And much as I would like to see Yugoslavia prosper, I mean, after all, it was a dream for any, Yugoslav person in many ways, it is proving an impossibility, because there's so many opposing interests, so many rivalries, so many forms of intolerance. And you can't do much about it. You know, there are now 8 or 9 different exchange rates in Yugoslavia. Because, did you know that? Each republic has its own exchange rate. And you can't do any transactions with anybody from abroad on your own, because, you see, you depend on so many of these complications. Now, no wonder that the inflation is there running into quarters like 2,000 at the moment, 2,000%, because it's an impossible system. It's a situation where, you see, if I'm, say, Minister of Finance in Serbia, I'm not going to take into account what the Croatians would like to do, what the Montenegrins would like to do, neither would they pay any attention to Serbian interests. Everybody is pulling his or her own way. So I'm surprised that, you know, the country has struggled along for as long as it has.
Well, thank you very much for explaining so well the complexities of the situation, because I think it's very important for people to understand that in order to appreciate the repatriation issue. And thank you very much indeed for explaining it so well.
Well, I tried to do, you know, what I could. Whether it is well, I don't know. It's all slapshod and, improvised and not often very clear. But, there's that gap, or memory gap, if you like. But on the other hand, some of these things remain, you know, pretty clear even to this day. I'm afraid the present doesn't augur well, which is disappointing, but what can I do?